salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free, Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Jesper Stein, Denmark's third best-selling author. He previously worked as a culture journalist, interviewing authors such as John le Carré, Ian Rankin, Margaret Atwood and Ian McEwan, before making his literary debut in 2012 with Unrest. It's the first in the Axel Steen series. His books have sold over 250,000 copies in Denmark and won a number of literary prizes. A film is currently in the making and the book Unrest is now published in English. Also with us is Matthew Crowe, who's worked as a freelance journalist since his teens and has written books for adults and young adults. His book, My Dearest Jonah, was nominated for the Dylan Thomas Prize. His latest book, Baxter's Requiem, is a glorious celebration of life, love, and seizing every last second we have while we're here. Also on this week's book show is Catherine Hughes, whose first novel, The Letter, was a digital number one and international bestseller. Her third novel, The Key, is a powerful, twisting novel that you won't be able to put down. It's set in 1956 and 2006. And also with us is Amelia Mandeville, who's a prolific YouTuber and one half of the Mandeville sisters. Her debut novel, Every Colour of You, is a love story with a difference that is both heartbreaking and heart-healing. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Denmark is Jesper Stein. He began his writing career as a journalist and covered the Balkan War and catastrophes in Africa. He then worked as a culture journalist for 10 years, interviewing writers such as John le Carré, Ian Rankin, Ian McEwan and Margaret Atwood. He made his literary debut in 2012 with Unrest, starring the detective Axel Steen. The books have sold over 250,000 copies in Denmark and won a couple of literary prizes as well. They're now published in English in the UK for the first time, starting with Unrest. Welcome to the book show, Jesper.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me, before we talk about your book, I wanted to learn a little bit about your background and interviewing those amazing writers I mentioned. They must have inspired you, did they?
It was a fantastic experience. Most writers, when you talk to them, are actually very, very nice and forthcoming, and especially John le Carré, I've interviewed four or five times in different cities around Europe, and he's really, really, I don't know if you can, if it's allowed to call him a nice bloke, but he's really a nice guy.
Oh, I'm sure it is allowed. Maybe if you said he was a horrible bloke, that would be more controversial.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll appreciate being called a nice bloke. So had you done a lot of writing before interviewing these authors?
Yes, I've been writing all my life, dreaming of getting published, writing poetry when I was in my 20s and existential novels when I was in my 30s. And then, of course, I've been working as a journalist for 20 years, and you write and write and write. And But it was only when I'm a bit of a late bloomer, you know. So I had to be in the middle of my 40s, late 40s, before I actually sort of had the stamina and the strength to go through a whole novel and get it published.
Yeah. So how does writing a novel compare to the journalism work that you've done?
It's really not very comparable, but I had the experience that before I published my first novel, 5 years before, I made a biography of a famous Danish policeman, an investigator in sort of the special branch we have in Denmark that works with homicide, difficult homicide.
Mm.
And that was sort of the experience that gave me the trust that I could could manage to write a whole novel of my own, and I had the feeling that sort of this biography was, you know, like if you put 25 long articles for a newspaper on top of each other and sort of glue them together. But I had the expectation before I wrote the book, but I had to realize that it was something completely different, because when you write a novel, you have to, I mean, it's so complicated, having the overall view of what is happening and sort of being very conscious of something happening in page one should also have a resonance in page 250 and page 400, and that's really different from, you know, news writing or journalism, where you can sort of you can already see the end when you wrote the first paragraph.
Mm. Yeah, it's a much bigger job writing a novel.
It is, and it's more like if you write a fiction novel, it's a great joy that you don't have to work so much with the facts. I know a lot of journalists are criticized for not being accurate on facts, but actually that's what we do. You know, it's most of the job is that you check all your sources and all the informations. But when you write a novel, you're sort of you're God in your own story or your own universe, so you can choose and pick everything else, and that's a great freedom.
Yeah,
and I love that very much.
So, tell me about your character then, Axel Steen. Did he come to you first then, before you started writing the book?
Yes, he's sort of been a voice inside of me for many years, sort of a fictional voice that is close to my own point of view of a lot of things and in life, and it was not difficult to sort of activate him. So he was there before anything.
Mm.
Of course, I had to sort of shape him, but he was there and he's still there. It's sort of it's a voice I can. It's like turning a tap of water on or off. So close is he to my experience, and yeah.
So what can you tell us about him?
Well, I can tell you that he's actually more inspired of some of the American or Anglo-Saxon tradition than he is of the Scandinavian crime tradition, because he's a lone wolf. A man of action. He acts before he thinks. He's impulsive. He is blue. He is a tough guy, and he has a soft inner side, that a sensitive inner side that doesn't often show it. And he is sort of a classical male anti-hero from the what I would call sort of the Hammett, Elroy, Michael Connelly, Ian Rankin style.
And will people like him?
I was actually a bit afraid that when I wrote my first novel, I thought that it would be a novel sort of appealing to men mainly because of the action. But the reality was that, and it has been still in Denmark then, and in all the other countries, the books has been translated to, that 90% of my readers are women, and they like Axel Steen very much. He sort of appeals to a combination of they want to save him, and because he's in a bad state in a lot of the books, and still he has this. There's this sort of bad boy fascination about him too. So
yeah.
I think that most of my readers actually like him. They are tearing the hairs out of their head while reading because of the things he do. But generally, in spite of all his flaws and all his mistakes, he's deep down is the core in his personality is more or less a knight in shining armor regarding the sort of the virtue of he wants to bring justice to the people who nobody cares to, and that's his goal in life. So there is something essentially very, very good inside him, and then there's a lot of bad things around him, around this.
Well, I suppose people like to be able to relate to someone. If a character's too perfect, then it's unrealistic, isn't it?
Then it's more or less boring to read it, I think. And the trend is, I think, in modern crime is that the writers are trying to find out how far can you go, how miserable or how unlikable can you make a character and still make the readers sort of sign up for the whole show.
Yeah.
And Axel Steen is in some of the books really
on the edge.
On the edge, not only looking down into the abyss, but far down into it.
Yeah.
But I mean, people still like him very much because there is something in him that everybody wants in their life.
Yeah. So without giving too much away, can you tell us a bit about what happens in Unrest?
Yes, I can. We had in 2007... Some pretty bad riots in Copenhagen because the police and the municipality closed down a youth house, a place where left-wing radicals had sort of grouped and could do whatever they would without nobody interfering. And they've been having this house for 25 years. And it was closed down and torn down, and there was riots all over the place. And the novels is set in a week after this abandonment of the house. And the police they find a corpse in the churchyard that lays just opposite the house. And the special thing is that this churchyard has been locked down by the police, so nobody has been able to enter it. And the guy, the dead guy, is sitting in a baklava mask, you know.
Balaclava, yeah.
And he is, so he's sort of more or less dressed like one of the radicals that has been expelled from the house. And this is a big problem for the police, and this is Axel Steen's job to find out who killed this guy. And very soon the intelligence service interferes because this guy, the dead guy, has been working or doing things for them, and everything gets pretty muddy.
Wow. And I understand a film is in the making with the producers who did The Bridge.
Yes. It's a big Scandinavian production firm company, and they are—they should start filming in fall next year.
Ah, exciting stuff! So it's happening.
Yes, it is.
Great.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. And how do you feel about your books being developed for the screen?
I feel, you know, it's. How should I explain? It's a good thing for me. It's a nice thing, but still, you know, when people read the impression people, my readers have of Axel Steen, if you go out and talk to people and talk to 20 people, they have, each of them has a different, what do you call it, picture of how this guy is and how he looks. And as soon as he's up on the screen, everybody, everybody, you know, relates to one person, to this person who is who embodies him
yeah.
in the film. So that, so I think you should, if you have, a, if you are working on a serial, then you should wait at least a couple of 3 or 4 or 5 books before you go into this, because it's a good thing that people, they have their own picture of the guy. But
yeah.
but still, it's very interesting, and I feel very good about it, and it's a great Danish director who shall, who is doing the first movie, and you know, he's been making HBO series in the States and a lot of Danish, great Danish movies, so
great.
I look forward to it.
And are you involved at all, or do you just kind of hand it all over to them?
You know, Ian Rankin told me once that, you know, there are two sort of ways of dealing with movies. One is get involved and get f***ed, as he said. The other is take the money and run. And I took the second solution. I listened to him.
Absolutely. Sounds like the best
yeah.
of the two, best of the two plans there.
I think it is, yeah. Because, I mean, no, but to be honest, it's like, I mean, movie script writers, they are probably better doing their job than I am. So, and they know a lot about of writing writing scripts to movies. I know a lot about writing crime novels. And, I,
yeah.
And the crime novels, of course, they are my my heartblood, you can say, you know. So, so if I have to, be, if I should be, when you adapt a crime novel to the screen, then you know that you have to cut something like maybe 60-70% of the subplots and, you know, the small detours and things like that in the book, and I wouldn't be the one to do that because I love all of it. So
yeah.
It's better that somebody else works with it, and then they will, and the movie will be, it'll not be sort of the adaptation of Jesper Stein's book. It will be a piece of art in itself, and you have to have respect for that as well.
Yeah,
I think.
Good attitude to have. If people want to get a copy of Unrest, it's out now and available to buy in the TRE bookshop section on our website. It's by Jesper Stein, who we've been talking to. Jesper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Matthew Crowe, who has worked as a freelance journalist since his teens. He's written a number of books for adults and also for young adults. His book, My Dearest Jonah, was nominated for the Dylan Thomas Prize. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, Baxter's Requiem. It's a glorious celebration of life, love, and seizing every last second we have while we're here. Welcome to the book show, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And I have to say, it's a lovely idea for a story. Tell us all about Mr. Baxter.
Mr. Baxter is 94 years old, and he's lived a very full and very rich life. And he's incredibly, he's in rude health for his age until he takes a fall. And then he is moved into an old people's home against his will and kind of faces his own mortality, I guess, and decides now is the time that he wants to travel to the war graves of France to say goodbye to a man called Thomas, who was his first great love. So against the wishes of the management at the care home, he runs away with one of the young employees and goes on an adventure to pay his respects to the man that he loved.
Oh, and the young employee is Greg, or Gregory, and he's got his own issues, if you like.
He does indeed, yeah. Gregory also has been affected sort of by homophobia to a degree. His younger brother recently killed himself, and Greg was expelled from school off the back of that when he attacked some people that he felt were responsible. So him and Baxter kind of bond, and the book, I guess, is about Baxter trying to pay his experience forward to Greg, really, to teach him that although terrible things happen, life can be quite a lovely place.
Yeah, it's a lovely idea of them forming this unlikely friendship, I guess, and sort of running off together to experience something, well, something new.
Yeah, exactly. I've always loved that sort of thing, like films and stuff, sort of multi-generational friendships I find really interesting, especially from a queer perspective. I think there's a lot to be learned from the older gay generation, which sometimes get ignored with things like online social media. You know, the world moves forward as well it should. But, you know, I do think there are stories that we need to listen to in order to understand that experience better as well, I guess.
Yeah. So do you know what kind of inspired the story or inspired some of the characters for you?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I mean, it started out as two books. It started out as notes on Gregory's story and on Baxter's story, and I couldn't get either of them to take flight, really. And then there was a couple of years ago in England a story about a man who ran away from an old people's home, not to pay respects to a loved one particularly, just to pay respects generally. And off the back of that, I kind of realised that inadvertently I'd been writing the same book, just taking the B road towards the same destination. So I linked them up both together. And the story just came pretty organically. And then, yeah, about halfway through writing those, well, the terrible Pulse massacre happened in Orlando. And I think it became, not more militant, but I think it grew slightly sharper teeth that became a quieter fury to the book than there had been there before.
Mm. So did you have the story very much before you had the characters, do you think?
No, I had the characters and the story. The characters existed and I had little notes and sort of witticisms, I guess, about the kind of things they would say, how they would say it, and then the story built around that. I start with character. I find it a lot easier. I think starting with stories too big, I struggle to whittle things down. I find it easier to build blocks on smaller ideas.
Mm. Is it important for you then to have a real understanding of the characters and, as you say, the kind of things that they would say or do before you write them into a story?
Oh, yeah, massively. I need to know the tone of voice and stuff much more than I need to know the narrative. Yeah, absolutely. I know the characters. I write a lot more than I publish. You know, the original text for the novel, I think, was about 95,000 words, and we cut it down to about 68,000. So, like, you know, nearly a third of it disappeared. Yeah, I need to have a pretty intricate knowledge of the characters before I start.
And how do you feel about that much of it disappearing during the editing process? Do you mind?
Yeah, massively. I was devastated initially. Then I decide when I get the notes, I'm never going to speak to my editor ever again. But then, you know, after you've had like 2 weeks to calm down, you kind of do what you're told. And then when you get the final proofs through, you realise that it really was for the greater good.
Yeah, but we have to trust them, don't you?
That's the thing, I think, with writing as well. It can feel so quite to sat at your own kitchen table, you're the duke in your own domain, but suddenly once it becomes this public property and other people's ideas start sort of coming in as a necessary evil or good, whichever way you look at it, it can be really, really shocking, and it's just a case of bending your head around the idea that it's no longer just your thing. It becomes a communal project. But again, it always ends up for the best.
Yeah. So how does it compare writing books for adults to books for young adults? Is there any difference in the writing process?
I think books for adults, you can sort of swim around a bit more. I think books for young adults, children and teenagers are really discerning readers. I think I think of as being more like writing for theatre or TV almost, in that you have to be in with the story within the first couple of pages, to be honest. Whereas I think for adults, you can sort of focus on character a bit and unfold. I mean, the narrative of Baxter doesn't really kick off until about maybe 3 or 4 chapters in. Before that, it's just establishing character, and that wouldn't hold sway in a YA novel, or at least not with my editor anyway.
Yeah, interesting. So is there one that you particularly enjoy writing more?
I think from a showing off point of view, probably books for adults, because you can be a bit more florid and a bit more self-indulgent to a degree, although a lot of that gets taken out. But yeah, also I enjoy writing, and books for adults tend to be longer. I quite like a big project. So overall, I would guess adult fiction, I'd probably prefer out the two.
Yeah. And I mentioned in the introduction, one of your books, My Dearest Jonah, was nominated for the Dylan Thomas Prize. Can you tell us a bit about that one?
Yeah, it was a huge surprise. It started out when I was really young, when I was like 18 or 19, and then that was my second book. And I was just with the tiniest little publisher called Legend Press, a really lovely imprint, but just a very small publisher. And then I got the email, and it was just massive. I never assumed I would be nominated for an award. You know, it was just nice to know that the publisher had submitted it, to be honest. That was a lovely thing, and to be nominated was great. And, you know, a small book from a small publisher suddenly built a bit of steam and got a bit of attention. It's lovely. You know, being a writer, I adore it, but, you know, it's tough market nowadays, less and less people buy books. So any sort of attention just feels like absolute cream. It's great.
So why do you think that did do particularly well? Can you tell us a bit about the story?
Yeah, it's epistolary, is that the word, where it's people writing letters to one another?
Right.
And I think it was closer to a mystery. There were two people who had met at a prison pen pal scheme, and they kind of formed this tentative love story. But the more that they wrote to each other, the more we sensed that they weren't being entirely honest. So I think it was probably my first book I was proud of. I was very young, but I think it was the first book I wrote where I kind of knew what I was doing, rather than just typing to show off, really. It was a lot more structured. And I think, you know, it has its faults, but I think it was a well-written book, really, and I was very proud of it at the time. I probably wouldn't write it now, but I'm pleased that I did at the time.
Yeah, and what was the thought behind that? What made you think of doing a book like that?
I'd read something somewhere about a prison pen pal scheme that went terribly wrong, and I'm fascinated by the whole prospect of, you know, the mindset of someone that would write to a long-term prisoner. In one way, it's a really altruistic thing. In another way, I think it's a really dark thing. And I just wanted to explore the mindset of someone that would go into that. I can't decide if I'm pro or against, really, and I didn't come away with an answer. You seldom do with a book, but I just thought it would be a really interesting idea to explore.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I've always thought the same, whether it's a really lovely and supportive, compassionate thing to do or a bit weird.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's comfortably in between the two, like most things do in life, really.
Yeah. So how long were you working on this book then? How long did it take to happen?
On Baxter, I spent probably about 6 months just mulling over the two different ideas for the characters. And then I guess I definitely hammered it out in under a year. I would say probably 9 months, maybe.
Okay.
Sort of sat at the desk actually writing. I tend to write very quickly and edit very slowly. I kind of bashed it out. And then it was just unfortunate that I finished it around Christmas time when we were submitting to publishers and my own current editor. So everyone was away and stuff. So it was kind of sort of late January, February into the next year by the time it sold.
And is that normal sort of process for you? Is that normally how long it all takes?
Yeah. It would be rare to take a year to write a book, but it's getting on that way, yeah.
And do you already know what you're doing next?
No, I've got a clue at the minute. I've been so busy with Baxter. I haven't got an idea. I just keep trying to push my agent and people off, saying I'm working on something, but I'm not. I'll sort something out soon, but it's just you get like a sort of, it's like when you take an exam and you come out and you're absolutely exhausted. You know, I've spent 9 months writing, then a good year editing, and then pre-publicity and stuff, and I'm just kind of, my bones have fallen out now. I'm just kind of relieved it's over, to be honest. I'm just, you know, taking a breather, I think.
Yeah. So if you haven't got any ideas, how would you go about trying to get an idea? Do you know how you, is it possible to try and find inspiration?
Yeah, it's people, really. It's just overhearing. Like I said, I start with character, so if I just overhear something, like even a tone of voice or just a little utterance, I always start with character and build from there. I think it's so much easier, like I said. I could never sort of start with an idea or that I want to address X or Y. I would find that so daunting. So it's just keeping your ears open, listening. People I find fascinating. And then it tends to snowball from there, really.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with Baxter's Requiem and the next book when you come to it. If people want to get a copy of Baxter's Requiem, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Matthew Crowe, who we've been chatting to. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
This is TRE.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Catherine Hughes. Her first novel, The Letter, was a digital number one and international bestseller. Her second novel, The Secret, has been highly acclaimed. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, the third book. It's called The Key. It's a powerful, twisting novel that you won't be able to put down. Welcome to the book show, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So how did you get into writing? What was your journey up to that first novel?
Well, back in 2007 it was now, when I first had what I thought was just a brilliant idea for a book, but it was just a germ of an idea. It would centre around the discovery of an old unposted letter, but as for who wrote it, who should have received it but didn't, who eventually found it, I had no idea. All I had was a brilliant title. It would be called The Letter. The problem was expanding that little idea to 90,000 words, which in the end took me about 3 years.
Wow. And how did you find it? You hadn't done anything like that before, presumably?
No, nothing like that before. I'd always worked in accounts. When my husband and I sold our business, obviously the new owners they want their own accountants in. So I just decided to crack on with this idea that I'd had.
And it worked well for you?
Yes, it did. Yes, absolutely.
Great.
It took about 3 years, and then I sent it off to various agents, and nobody wanted it. About a dozen agents rejected it, and then I just thought, well, I've spent so long writing it, you know, I wrote it so people could read it. So back then, I think it was 2013 now, I stuck it in the Kindle store myself, and miraculously people just liked it, read it, reviewed it, recommended it, and somehow it got to number one.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well done. So you'd recommend publishing online then and self-publishing?
Well, it certainly worked for me, but that was back in 2013. There is a lot more people doing it now. And even back then, there was over 2 million books in the Kindle store. So putting it up there is one thing. It's directing people to it. That is another. I mean, that's the same with any book. It's all to do with publicity, marketing, you know, finding the audience.
Yeah. So was the letter eventually published in the end?
Yes, it was, because it went to number one in the Kindle chart, obviously. Then not only was it visible to readers, it was also visible to editors and publishers, and I was approached directly by Headline with the offer of a publishing contract. I'd only ever published myself in ebook, so I hadn't had a paperback, but Headline published the paperback and gave me a two-book deal.
Oh, fantastic. So how did you find writing the second novel, The Secret, compared to the first? Had you learnt a lot after the first one?
I think with the publishing contract comes a deadline, and there's nothing like a deadline to focus the mind. So even though the first book took me, from initial idea, it was 6 years, The Secret only took 12 months, but I was working on it virtually full time.
Yeah, so you found it easier, I guess, than the first one, did you?
Yes, in many ways, because in the first one, when I say it took me 6 years, I'd go for months without looking at it and then picking it up and having to start reading it again. With The Secret and indeed The Key, that was also written for the same timescale, it was more focused, definitely.
So let's talk about The Key then. It's set in two different time periods, 1956 and 2006, and it kind of centres around a lunatic asylum.
It does. That's the main focus of the book in the earlier thread, the Ambergate County Lunatic Asylum. We meet a naive student nurse, Ellen Crosby. She just starts working there, and she's horrified by the treatment of the patients, and she determines that she's going to make a difference. She befriends a troubled young patient, Amy Sullivan, who's been sent to the asylum by her father. And Ellen is forced to make a decision which will change the course of many lives. And then in the later thread, half a century later, Sarah's drawn to the now derelict asylum which she has connections with. And whilst exploring, she discovers an attic full of suitcases belonging to former inmates, one of which contains something truly shocking.
Wow.
But the inspiration for that came from a true story.
Oh, really?
I read about the Willard Asylum for the Chronic Insane in New York State. And in 1995, some years after the asylum had closed, a cleaner was going about, you know, doing what she was supposed to do. And behind a locked attic door, she discovered a collection of over 400 suitcases belonging to former patients.
Okay.
They had to surrender their belongings. And some of these patients had been there most of their lives. To be honest, if you went into that asylum, and indeed many our asylums were the same, you know, you never came out again. It became institutionalised. It became your home.
Mm. So what was in all these suitcases then, in the true story?
If anybody wants to know more about it, if you just Google the Willard suitcases would do it. All sorts. I mean, photographs, medicines, clothes, beautiful hairbrush sets. How do you pack for a stay in a lunatic asylum? You've got absolutely no idea how long you're going to be there. You can't even wear your own clothes. You're given, hospital issue clothes anyway, so you actually don't need any of your personal belongings, but they are stored so come the day you are released.
Wow,
so I thought that was just a marvellous premise. I thought, what could be in this case? Taken off this young girl, and anyway, you have to read it to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you have the plot kind of figured out in a way before the characters? Was the plot the key thing here?
Yes, I always start with a premise, and then I introduce the characters. And even though I know where the book's going to start and where it's going to finish, I might deviate along the way as to how I get to that point, because you get to know the characters more as you're writing about them, and they become real people. And then I might have thought about them acting in a certain way, and then I think, actually, I know more about this character now, and she wouldn't do that, so I have to think of something else to make it more realistic. So there's a bit of deviation, but I always get to the ending that I originally thought of.
And then why did you decide to set it in the two different parts? How did you pick that it was going to be 1956 and 2006?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question, actually. No one's asked me that before. Because in 1956, I wanted to depict the horrors of the asylum system back then with the treatments. We were lobotomizing people. We were electric shock treatment, which I just hasten to say, ECT is still used today to great effect. So I don't want to sort of pour cold water on that treatment. But back then, it was done without anaesthetic, without muscle relaxants. Ugh. People were breaking bones when they convulsed. And just the horrors of being able to be committed to an asylum just because you were depressed or a moral imbecile, maybe had a baby out of wedlock, or there didn't seem to be much reason for people being committed, and then they'd end up spending their whole lives there. So I really wanted to depict the horrors of that.
Yeah, absolutely shocking. I bet a lot of people don't realise that.
No, that's right. Oh, the research was fascinating, and unfortunately the book would have been twice as long had I included it all. So we need to sort of be, selective. Hopefully I've depicted something of what it was like back then.
Great. And can I ask, or is it giving it away, if you explain what the title means, the key? What is the key?
It has sort of a dual title, to be honest. The key is a physical key, the key to opening the suitcase that contains this something shocking, but also the key to put Amy, the patient, the main character in the earlier thread. The doctor, the psychiatrist, is trying to unlock what's going on in her mind. I think it's not giving too much away to say that she's not actually mad or mental or whatever other label the doctor's put on her. So it's sort of like, a philosophical key, a metaphorical key, to unlocking what is really going on in her brain.
Great stuff. Well, if people want to read The Key, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Catherine Hughes, who we've been talking to. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
TRE. Talk Radio. Europe.
TRE. TRE. TRE.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is prolific YouTuber Amelia Mandeville. She's one half of the Mandeville sisters, and she's appeared on Harry Potter, CBBC, MTV and Gogglebox. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel, Every Colour of You. It's a heartbreaking, heart-healing story described as a love story with a difference. Welcome to the book show, Amelia.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. And congratulations. I know you're very excited to have your first book out.
Yeah. It's an exciting time for me.
Have you been thinking about it for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to get a book published since I was 16, so yeah, a couple of years now.
And how old are you now?
21.
Oh, that's amazing. To have a book out at 21, though, is still pretty cool. Was it a struggle then to get a publisher?
Yeah, it was. And like, I've known about this, having a book deal, for like nearly a year and a half now. So it's been a long time coming to actually like getting the book out. So yeah, it's been a long journey.
Well, before we talk about the book, I have to ask you about your YouTube channel. I was having a look this morning and there's some great videos on there. Why did you create it with your sister?
So we just created it because I wasn't at college, so I was just working in a supermarket, and my sister had just finished college, and it was just that kind of period where we're just a little bit bored. So we just kind of created it for fun, and then now it's kind of something that we do, which is cool.
And how does that happen? How do you go from just putting up some videos for fun to getting hundreds of thousands of followers?
I'm not really sure. I think YouTube's very different now than it was back then. I think it was a little bit, this was like 3 or 4 years ago, so it was a little bit easier to like meet other YouTubers and grow as a community and sort of stuff. But now I think it's really big, and it's like this whole big world. So I think we did it at a time where it was just like small, and you met lots of other people and you just become friends with them. And I think you're like channels would get noticed a bit easier. So yeah, I think we're just lucky. I don't know.
Yeah. So how do you get people to find you and follow you?
Honestly, I really don't know. I don't know. I think just some videos really resonate with people, and then maybe it will pop up on their feed and people will watch it. I really don't know. I everyone always asks me this, and I'm like, I think I'm just lucky.
Oh, well, there's some skill in there as well, I'm sure.
Hopefully.
So how do you decide what you're going to do a video about?
It really depends. Like, we used to do a lot of comedy sort of stuff. It would be a lot of like skits and sort of like sketches, but then we realized we were just doing it because we kind of thought that was the direction our channel was in. But as we've grown up, we've done a little bit more fashion, a little bit more lifestyle, and we started to do it more for like us. I talk quite openly about mental health as well on my channel, and my sister has one hand, so she talks about like disability and like positive, like being body positive and stuff like that. So yeah, we're just more doing stuff that we would like to talk about, and maybe when we were younger, the sort of videos we'd want to watch.
Yeah, I watched a bit of the video. It started, I mean, here's where the comedy comes in, the video about your sister talking about having one hand, and how that it was your fault, you basically flushed her arm down the toilet and she was like really sad. And I was thinking, oh my god, this is awful, I've got to interview this girl in a bit. And then suddenly she starts laughing, she's like, no, only kidding, I was born this way. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah,
it did make me laugh.
Yeah, Grace is actually quite good at making her her little jokes with the one hand. I mean, like, she's got one hand, so she can do it, so may as well. Like, on Halloween, she goes all out and she, like, puts blood all over it, and it really does scare people.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Good for her. So, she explained in the video that she, I mean, barely kind of notices. It doesn't kind of get in the way of her life, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we try to do on our channel, really. We just try to, you know, everybody's different, but if you're looking at it badly, like, you know, if it's a physical disability or like mental health, whatever it is, we just try to explain, you know, every differences are good.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. So tell me about your appearances on Harry Potter.
Oh, so it's not as impressive as it sounds, but, you know, it's Harry Potter, so I can always use the name drop for that. But our uncle, he works on film sets, and he was working on Harry Potter, and so me and my sister both got to do like be an extra, but it was really funny because I'm not actually seen. So Grace filmed like maybe 2 years before me, and she was there for one day, and you see her like go past the screen, and then I was there for like nearly a week, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm definitely going to be seen. I've been here so long, and like I was making friends with like all the crew and stuff, and it was great. And then you can't see me, so I was like, oh, at least I can say, and I have a photo, so that's my proof.
Oh, brilliant. So let's talk about your debut novel then, about Every Colour of You, it's called. Where did you get the idea from?
It's really funny, I actually don't know. I'm the sort of person that I always try to think in my head. I'm like away with the fairies half the time, and I like just thinking in a fictional world and stuff. And I mean, I wrote this book at a time where I wasn't going through, like, the best sort of time in my life. I was having my own little struggles, and I didn't have a very good, like, physical health. And so it was just almost like an escape for me. And, you know, the two characters are very different, and there's, like, bits of both characters that I relate to. But I really wanted to do a book about mental health from a boy's perspective, because I think that is something that boys struggle like emitting. And I hate the thing like, you know, boys shouldn't cry, don't cry, don't let your emotions out. And I wanted to do that sort of story, so yeah, it just kind of happened.
So the two main characters are Zoe and Tristan, is that right?
Yeah.
So tell us more about Zoe.
So Zoe's the sort of person that I would love to have as a friend. She's really bubbly, she's happy-go-lucky, she's almost a bit annoying, actually, which I try to make her a bit annoying. She's just so positive. She's so just, like, nothing will bother her. And she has purple hair, and she wears really funky clothes. And she lives life, like, making the most of every single day. And, you know, when she meets Tristan, she kind of wants to like change his life, to make him see life the way she does. So yeah, she's nice, I like her.
So Tristan's the one who's going through a bad time.
Yeah, Tristan, he's been away for a couple of months because he had really bad depression after his dad died, and he's just getting back into work and meeting people, and he runs into Zoe, and they couldn't be more opposite, but for some reason like they start coming into each other's life. But he gets very annoyed at Zoe just because he just doesn't understand why she's so happy all the time.
Yeah. So now the book's out, has it made you want to write more?
Yeah, I'm always writing. So I've written two novels before I wrote this one, and I'm currently writing another one. I just always like writing, I think. I don't know what I'd do with myself. However, when I did write this book, I didn't have, like, the biggest social life, or, like, I just didn't really do much, and now I do, so I'm like, oh, okay, I've got to, like, knuckle down.
Yeah, it's difficult to combine the two, isn't it? Your social life can suffer if you're writing a book.
Yeah, but it's good. It feels like I'm making friends through my writing, so.
Oh, brilliant. So the other books that you're doing, are they follow-on books? Have they got the same characters, or are they all completely different?
No, it wouldn't be a follow-on, because I'm not sure if I ever would do follow-on books, but I quite like, when I read a book, I like to kind of assume where my characters have gone. Like, I like to think in my head. So I hope, you know, people who read my book can make their own ending up, or make their own journeys for the rest of my characters. So, like, I'm giving them a small bit of the story, and they can carry on and do whatever they want or think where they go. So,
yeah. Well, if people want to check out your YouTube channel, it's youtube.com/ Mandeville Sisters, and they can get a copy of Every Colour of You. We'll put it up on our website so listeners can get it from our TRE bookshop section. Amelia Mandeville, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityCairo.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.